Give that final hug or handshake. Hello to all of you who do not own cottages. Glad to have you here. We really did wonder if it would be the three of us, so we're overjoyed to have you with us. Great to be here. I'm excited about this morning. I'm actually pretty bummed in a sense that what we're talking about today falls on this weekend, because what we're talking about is so central to understanding the Old Testament, and I wish everybody could hear it, because it's kind of that important. So way to go. Hopefully you think the same thing when we're done, because what we're talking about today is the law. The law. Dun, dun. Yes, right? How do you feel about the law? Anybody feel good about the law? Had a run-in with the law lately? Maybe you don't feel so good about it, you know? But I'm talking about the law as in like the Old Testament law. We're going to talk about that today. This is what God gives to the Israelites once they are freed from Egypt. And anybody remember or know what the foundation of the law is? What's the central part of the law in the Old Testament? What's it called? Do you know? The Ten Commandments. Have you heard of these? The Ten Commandments actually are everywhere. My family and I are vacationing in Michigan City. We're driving down through Michigan City yesterday, and outside of a church are these replica stone tablets with words engraved in them. There was a judge down in one of the southern states not that long ago who got in all kinds of trouble because he wouldn't allow the Ten Commandments to be removed from the courthouse. Do you remember this whole debate? Like, the Ten Commandments show up quite often in our culture, and not just in those ways, but actually in pop culture as well. In fact, Nate and I this week were, at our staff meeting and chatting about this, and Nate said, "Oh, do you remember that one clip from that one movie?" And I was like, "No, I actually don't know that clip." And he said, "You've got to check this out.
Lord, I shall give these laws to thy people. Hear me. Oh, hear me. Oh, pay heed. The Lord Jehovah, has given unto you these 15. Ten commandments for all to obey."
In most churches, I would get fired for showing that, I think. But not here, and it's just to add on to what Nate is saying, you know. One reason to love this place. The point is that the Ten Commandments show up all over the place. I'm not advocating that there were 15. I think there probably were 10. And so we're going to talk about the law today, the Ten Commandments, as well as some of the other parts of the law, because in the Old Testament, the law extends well beyond the Ten Commandments. We're going to talk about that today. But before we get there, and by the way, we'll be in Exodus 19. So if you have a Bible and you want to start getting a head start, finding your way to kind of our key text, you can do that now. Before we get there, let's just remember where we are in this journey. Last week, the people of Israel were set free from Egypt after a 10th and final plague. And that's kind of where we ended last Sunday, was with their freedom. But we didn't even get to the kind of coolest part of the story last week. Remember what happens? The Israelites are set free. Pharaoh finally lets them go, and they're not gone long when Pharaoh gets kind of a buyer's remorse, but it's like a liberator's remorse. You know what I mean? He's like, "Oh, I really shouldn't have let them go. That was a bad idea." So he mounts his chariot, gets some other chariots, and they start chasing after the Israelites, and they catch up to them. And as the Israelites see them off in the distance, they freak out because, of course, they can't outrun them. The Egyptians are in chariots. And even if they could, they have this thing called the Red Sea in front of them. It's kind of a problem, you know. So they are freaking out. And then what happens? Remember what happens in the story? You just shout it out. Yeah, how does God help them? That's right. You're right, Silas. God moves the water, and the Israelites go through, and the Egyptians follow, and the Israelites make it out on the other side, and the Egyptians don't. Right? And that's like the start of the Exodus. And when they get to the other side, the people of Israel shout and sing and dance because they're finally free. They're finally free. Well, then, it's interesting, all that freedom, all that celebration, all that joy, they then begin this three-month journey by foot to a place that may be familiar to us, a mountain that has shown up already in the story of the Exodus. They arrive at the mountain called Sinai, or Horeb. It has two names in the scriptures. And we encountered this mountain earlier, back in Exodus 3. So if you're really kind of a person keeping notes, and you can jot a little thing in your margins in Exodus 19 to tell you to go back to Exodus 3, because there you find, I think, yes, there it is, perfect. This is back when Moses was living as an exile in the wilderness. Now, Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, Sinai, the mountain of God. And then Moses sees the burning bush, and he and God have some interaction. And then in verse 12, God said to Moses, I will be with you as you go to Pharaoh and demand the release of my people. I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. So God says, there's going to be a time when you're going to come back here, and that's how you'll know that I've been faithful and I've been with you. So here in Exodus 3, we got Mount Sinai, God, one dude, and a small little fire, right? The burning bush. In Exodus 19, things get amped up. In Exodus 19, same mountain, same God, but now instead of just one man, Moses, it's all of Israel, and the entire mountain is now on fire, not just a little bush. The entire mountain is, in a sense, on fire. Look at what it says in Exodus 19, down in verse 16. On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. You would too. All right, the whole thing is going up. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace, and the whole mountain trembled violently. This language is all meant to tell us that something's about to go down. All right? Something's about to happen. The mountain's on fire. All right? And the people then, and we should as well, take note. Now, the question maybe to ask here is, why has God brought them to this mountain? What's about to happen? Why are they there? We have to remember where we are in the story. Israel, the people, the Hebrew people, up until this point have been what? They've been only one thing. Slaves. Some of you are whispering, and you can say it loudly next time. Slaves. Yeah, they've been slaves. Because you got the right answer. That's all they've known. We maybe forget that. I don't know. We think of Israel as a nation that just kind of was there all along. They were not there all along. They were slaves. That's all they knew, was how to be the slaves of Pharaoh. But now they are the children of Yahweh. And they have no idea what that means. What does that mean to be a child of the king? Of the king of the cosmos, not a slave of the king of Egypt. What does it mean to be a child of God? What does that kind of life look like, right? How do you live as free people? All we've known is how to live as slaves. So God brings them to this mountain. Why? To show them how to live in this world that God has made. Anyone here a fan, a watcher of Kimmy Schmidt, Unbreakable? Anybody? Few of you, come on. No? This side of the room? No, not so much. Okay, you should. Season one especially. I don't know, season two, what do you think? It's going to, you know, not as good. Okay, so Kimmy Schmidt is this Netflix TV show about these women who were taken hostage. They were kidnapped and forced to live in a bunker. And they were sold all these lies by this cult leader guy. About life on the outside and why they needed to stay in this bunker and they had to serve him and all this stuff. They lived in this small little world in this bunker, really, in a sense, as slaves. And the show is about her getting out and having to figure out how to live in the world as a free person. It's hilarious. Very funny. That's kind of what's going on here. Now, Kimmy has some people in her life who guide her from time to time, often quite poorly, about how to live in this world as a free person. But God here with Israel is showing them how to live as a free people who've only known slavery in a little bunker buried in the earth. That's all they've known. And now they're free. And so God says, here, let me give you the law. Dun-dun. Not really dun-dun, actually. It's like do-do-do-do. It's the law. It's like the best thing in the world because it shows you how to live life as a free person in this world, as a child of God. Now, again, I think we have mixed feelings about the law. Yes? I think the Old Testament law we have mixed feelings about. Some of it we might read and go, oh, it's beautiful. It's amazing. It's cool. I get it. Makes a lot of sense. There are other parts of the law that might put us to sleep. Has anyone read Leviticus lately? Anyone? Interesting. What a surprise. Do you know why you haven't? Because it's boring. You know, it's really hard to read. Or there are parts of the law that we read and we go, what in the world is God talking about? This is the most bizarre thing I've ever read in my life. Yes? Anybody encountered those parts of the law? Okay. So what do we make of the law? I want to offer three things that I think are true about the law that we see in Exodus and Leviticus. And if you're a note taker, and I'm telling you what, this is a Sunday to jot some things down, I would suggest to you. The first thing about the law that we have to understand, as foreign as it can feel to us, is that the law is all about relationship. Everything that God is doing in Exodus, including here at Mount Sinai, is about the formation and the deepening of relationship. And if you're not sure about whether or not this is true, and if you have your Bible open, look at Exodus 19:4. The beginning of Exodus 19:4, that verse, says this. God is speaking, by the way, to Moses. He says, "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings." Anybody seen Lord of the Rings? Read the books, right? The eagles, are they not the most awesome thing in the world, right? They don't show up all that much, but when they do, and like that end scene where they take Frodo and Sam off of Mount Doom and carry them away, you know? It's this beautiful picture, actually quite helpful for me, because what does it mean to be on eagle's wings? Oh, it means to be carried away. It means to be protected. It means to be drawn close. And then God goes on in the last part of that verse. You know, I've carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. That's very relational language. Would you not agree? And then in verse 9, God says, I am going to come to you. Now, we're Christians in the 21st century. I don't know. Maybe this gets lost on us. But to people in that day and time, for whom the gods were viewed as distant and apathetic, right? This God is different. This God is with you and for you. This God speaks in terms of relationship, in terms that are personal. This God draws close to you, takes the first step to come near to you. This is radical stuff. And in the Ten Commandments, we get a sense of how much God is committed to this relationship and wants us to understand about what it looks like to live in relationship. First, the first few commands, the first four commands, are primarily about our relationship with God. You shall have no other gods before me. Okay? You shall not make for yourself an image. I don't know. Have you heard these before? Does this feel a little like, oh yeah, okay, no gods before me, image? This would have been so revolutionary because any other ancient religion had images, idols, things that you could touch and see, you know, in the physical world that we live in, and you would worship those things. God says, no, no, no. My relationship with you is going to go deeper than just some physical idol symbol thing. It's going to reach down into your very soul. That's the kind of relationship. So this is, again, maybe gets lost on us, but it would not have been lost on the people of that day. This is a different God. God says, you shall not misuse the name of the Lord. We think that usually means not saying a a profane cuss word that I will not say right now in church, right? That's what we shouldn't do. In the ancient world, you would invocate the name of your God to get the God to do something for you. It's like just saying the right magic words. Say the right words and the God will unlock fertility, will unlock the harvest. You just had to use the name of the God in the right way. And God says, I'm not a genie, you know? Again, this is about a relationship, not just you coming and me spitting out some vended good. Okay, and then number four, remember the Sabbath. Which for my mom growing up meant that my mom's family, you could play catch on the Sabbath, but you couldn't play baseball. Right? We've often developed very interesting rules around the Sabbath to try and keep this one. The Sabbath is not about whether you can play baseball or catch or neither or both. It's about remembering the Lord your God. It's a day dedicated to remembering that what we get, what we have in this life comes from God. Okay, so there's the first four, our relationship with God. And then the rest are our relationship with each other. Honor your father and mother. Children. Get that one? Number five. Critical one. Number six, you shall not murder. Number seven, you shall not commit adultery. Number eight, you shall not steal. Number nine, you shall not give false testimony. And number 10 is that you shall not covet anything that belongs to your neighbor. It's all about relationship. How do we live in relationship with each other? How do we live in relationship with God? See, what God is doing here for Israel is showing them how to live life outside of slavery, how to live the best life that they can in this world, which reminds me of Legos. My kids love Legos. I grew up loving Legos. Legos. And so we have a table upstairs dedicated to Legos. Our kids will gather around it, primarily JP and Rhea right now. They'll gather around it and they build structures, vehicles, places to dwell, characters get involved. And every once in a while, I'll go up there and just kind of, step up to the table and start trying to play with them. And before too long, inevitably, they say to me, "Dad, you're doing it wrong. You know, that person can't fly." And I say to them, "Guys, it's my imagination. It's a Lego. Of course he can fly. I mean, anything can happen in Lego world, right?" "No, Dad. No, in this world, that person can't fly." Okay. So down to the ground we go and we keep playing. It's not a few more minutes before they say to me again, Dad, no, you can't do that. You know, you have to do this. Or in this world, these people are on the same team or you can drive your car in this. Like, they have all these boundaries about this world that they've created, all these rules, all this way to interact in this world. I think maybe something like that is going on with the law. God is saying to Israel, in order to fully participate in this world, frankly, in order to have joy and peace, you have to understand that this world works a certain way. And you're called to operate in that way, to be in relationship with people a certain way, to be in relationship with me a certain way. There's a way to operate in this world that leads to life. If that helps, there you go. The law and Legos together. But you can see it's all about relationship. The second thing, just to point out really quickly, is that the law is about every aspect of life. The law covers everything that Israel's going to have to be concerned with. Not just relationships, but in Exodus 21, 22, 23, God gives Israel a number of other laws that cover things like worship. How do they worship? How do they handle crimes? How do they negotiate economic activity? What about the religious festivals? How do they care for animals? What do they do when they have legal disputes? How do they handle bribes? So much stuff is covered in just those few chapters. And then you have this whole book in the Old Testament called Leviticus devoted to the law. Breaks down in even further detail, again, things about worship, how to offer sacrifices, what can and cannot be eaten in life, how to handle certain medical conditions. And I know that a lot of the stuff in Leviticus we scratch our head at and go, what's going on there, right? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us at first. But when you step back, One of the things you realize about the law is that God is giving it to Israel so that every part of their life can come under God's reign. God cares about every part of their life, every aspect of it. So God gives instructions about all those different things because God cares about all of it, not just their religious life, not just their economic life, or their relation, all of life. So that's number two, I'd say, about the law. And the third is that the law is both historical and radical. This is probably worth a whole series of sermons on its own, so forgive me in the 5 minutes that we're going to spend here at best. But I do want to say a word about the law being both historical and radical, because again, I think we read parts of the law and go, this thing is bonkers. Right? Have you read it lately? If you've read it, you would say it's bonkers. I mean, there are parts of it that just don't connect to us. And I think we get uncomfortable with that. But as obvious as this is going to sound, I'm going to say it anyway. We have to remember that the law was written to a particular group of people in a particular place at a particular time in history. And we should not be surprised, therefore, that this law reflects those people at that time in that place. That just shouldn't really be that much of a surprise to us. If the law feels primitive, if it feels like it was written 3,000 years ago, it's because it was, right? It was written a long, long time ago when the world was so different. Now, that's not like a blanket excuse, but we do have to remember that. That it was written to a people in a place and a time that was unique. And I think just like God did not ask Israel, and just like God does not ask us to separate ourselves from our time and place, God has his law fit or be recognizable for its time. So it's historical. It comes out of a particular place and a particular time and a particular people. And yet, it is radical. It may not feel that way to us at first, but this law that God gives to the people of Israel is crazy. Let me just give you a few examples. And by the way, I mean crazy in the best sort of way. All right. So here's an example. Exodus 22, 1 to 15 is a whole set of laws about what to do when someone steals something. Okay. And the punishment for stealing. Thanks. Yeah. When the punishment for stealing is significant, but in the ancient world, most of the laws of most of the cultures actually valued property above people. And so the punishment for the crimes of murder actually were often less than the punishment of the crimes for stealing something, stealing property. In God's law, it is reversed. Human life is valued more than property. Again, this, we're like, yeah, duh, you know. But in that day and time, this would have been a radical shift. This would have been a big deal to someone who was living in that day and time. Or take Leviticus 23, 22. Leviticus 23, 22, God says to Israel, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings, the stuff that's fallen of your harvest. Leave them for the poor and for the foreigner residing among you. I am the Lord your God. Friends, there was no mire, right? There was no mire back in this day. There was no backup when the pantry became empty. Your harvest was everything to you. It was life and death. And God says, don't harvest all your fields. Leave the edges and the stuff that you drop for the person who is poor and for the person who isn't even a part of the Hebrew people, the foreigner living among you, even those people get to come and take some of what I blessed you with. That is so radical in that day and time. It's so counterintuitive. It would have blown people away. And then how about Leviticus? Back to the Ten Commandments. We talked about those things, about not making an image, how radical that was, how God desired to be in relationship with people. And then in Leviticus 1, verse 1, so this is the very beginning of a book, an entire book dedicated to the law. This is what God says to Moses. The Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting. He said, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, when anyone among you brings an offering to the Lord," and then God goes and gives a whole bunch of instruction about what happens when people bring an offering to the Lord. Do you know what the word offering means in Hebrew? Neither did I. It means to draw near. I probably would have guessed that it meant like a piece of food or an animal or something like that. It means to draw near. Now, the gods in the ancient world were an ornery bunch. If you didn't offer the right offering in the right way, you could get in some trouble, you know, and you certainly wouldn't unlock whatever power they had to offer you. But this God is different. This God invites you to draw near. This God invites you into relationship. In fact, in Leviticus, God gives instruction for something called a peace offering. It was an offering that you would give to just recognize and mark the reality that you were at peace with God. Again, this was not a common thing in that day and time. You were never at peace with the gods. You were always scared to death that, in fact, you had wronged the gods somehow. God says, you know what? There's a whole part of our worship system that you can enter into that will remind you that you are at peace with me. And do you know how they ended that peace offering? They took some of the meat that had been sacrificed on the altar, essentially cooked on the altar, and they ate it. What do we call it when people sit down and eat something? Not a trick question. A meal. Call it a meal. Yeah? Call it a meal. So this peace offering ends with a meal. How do you know you're at peace? You have a meal in which you eat some of the sacrifice and in which God is present and, in a sense, has some of the meal as well. I mean, this is, again, I don't know how it feels to you in this moment, but I'm just telling you, to people of that day and time, to have a meal with a God who invites you into a meal, that is just, you know, mind-blowing sort of stuff. So the law may feel weird because of its historical context. We may not be able to make sense of all of it. And yet, if we look closely, we realize it is really a radical law. It moved the people forward significantly towards the kind of life that God really imagines for humanity. So, there are three things about the law. Three characteristics of it. That God is radically gracious in it. That it covers every aspect of life because God cares about every aspect of our lives. And it is all about relationship. Here's the thing, though. We still haven't gotten to the most, I think, important question. And that is why? What's the purpose of the law? Those are some characteristics about it, but what's the purpose of it? Well, in Exodus 19, we read these words. This is just before the Ten Commandments. God's speaking to Moses again, and he says, "Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, if you obey the law, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." If you are marking anything in your Bible, I would encourage you to underline kingdom of priests and holy nation. We're going to talk about those two phrases here just a little bit. Because those are the purpose, right? God says if you obey the law, what will happen? You'll become a holy nation a kingdom of priests. What does that mean? Let's start with a holy nation. Anybody want to wager, just kind of throw out, what does it mean to be holy? I know, this is a tricky word. It's a tricky word. What do you think? Set apart? Yeah, that's definitely a very kind of common way to talk about being holy. To be unique. To be different. Other than, right? God is often described as holy, but God here is saying to Israel, you are to be holy. So what does it mean? Okay, work with me here. Stay with me. God has given Israel the law, which was radically different from the other laws of its time. And God says here in verse 5, if you obey me fully, then every relationship, every aspect of life will be different. It will be unique from the rest of the people in the world. And make no mistake, the world will take notice. They will look at your life and wonder why it is so different, why it looks so full, so rich, so deep. And they will be drawn to what you have. You will live differently, people will notice, and they will be drawn to you to wonder why you are living that kind of life. And when they are drawn to you, you are to be a kingdom of priests. So you're to be different, people will notice, and when they do, you're to be a kingdom of priests. What does it mean to be a priest? This one's actually pretty tricky, I think. It probably means a lot of things, I suppose. Maybe you could sum up the job of a priest, though, in this way. You could call a priest a facilitator of connection. A facilitator of connection. Because what a priest did was they helped the people of God connect to God. And by bringing God's word or God's reign back to the people, they helped God connect to the people. They were this facilitator of connection. I don't know. Take it or leave it. That's what I was thinking about this week. Facilitators of connection. So God says to Israel, you are priests, a kingdom of them. When people notice that your life is different, what you're supposed to do in that moment is connect them to God. You're to help them draw close to me. You're to tell them what I've done in your life, how I've been active in your life, what I've done in the history of Israel, and you're to draw people to me. You're to be priest in that way. All right. That's their calling, holy nation, kingdom of priests. How does Israel do at this? Thumbs up, thumbs down. What would you say? Let's show hands. Thumbs up, thumbs down. How did Israel do? Mostly thumbs down. Maybe this. You know, sometimes, like, yeah, all right, you know. But most of the time, the rest of the Old Testament is all about whether or not Israel does this. Do you know that? That's the rest of the Old Testament. Does Israel live into this calling or not, and what happens as a result? Okay, so we know it's a mixed bag, you know, sometimes. So if you have a Bible, turn to 1 Peter chapter 2. You're like, what? This is a series on the Old Testament. I know. Go there anyway. 1 Peter chapter 2. Way, way, way at the end of the Bible. Because here's the thing. I think we understand Israel. I think we get Israel. I think we know what it's like to struggle to live as a holy nation or a kingdom of priests. We understand how hard it is to live out the law. We're not strong enough, smart enough, resilient enough. We're just not enough of anything to do it all the time. Which is why God sends Jesus. You know what Jesus does? Jesus lives the life that Israel was always meant to live. He is the fulfillment of the law. That's why he says in Matthew 5, I didn't come to abolish the law. I came to what? You know this verse? It says, I came to fulfill it. I came to live it out perfectly, not to get rid of it, but to be what Israel was always meant to be. That's what Jesus does. And in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, Peter's talking about Jesus, and he says this about him. You're coming to Christ, who is the living cornerstone of God's temple. He was rejected by people, but he was chosen by God for great honor. Jesus is the cornerstone. Peter's saying that God is building something, okay? God's building something. Jesus is the most important stone, the first stone. And then he goes on in verse 5 to say, and you are living stones, part of this temple. Your life becomes a part of this thing that God is building. And then down in verse 9, this should get all sorts of bells and whistles going off in our minds. Peter says this, for you are a chosen people. You are royal priests. You are a holy nation, God's very own possession. As a result, you can show others the goodness of God, for he called you out of the darkness into his wonderful light. Sound familiar? It's not an accident that Peter's talking about this. He's saying, listen, God is building something new, but he borrows this old language for us. God's building something new, but as God does, our calling still remains quite similar. We are royal priests, a holy nation. And our calling is to show others the goodness of God. To tell other people about how God has brought us out of darkness into light. So, here's the question we're going to end with after our very quick sprint through the law. What would it look like this week for you to be a priest? Probably no requirement to perform a wedding. No sermon to prepare. We've got that covered next Sunday. You know, what would it look like for you to be a priest this week? What would it look like for you to show someone else the goodness of God? Maybe it might mean offering care to someone who is hurting. You could be a priest that way. If you came alongside of someone and showed them that in your life, God has brought you out of darkness and God will do the same for them, that would be being a priest. When someone wrongs you this week, and someone will wrong you, one way to be a priest would be to show that person mercy. Right? To live a different kind of life, a holy life, a different life, and in doing so, help connect someone else to God. Because, you know, what does the world expect when you've been wronged? They expect you to seek revenge, to hold a bitter grudge. And when we choose mercy, we're living a holy life that can lead us to help others connect to God. Or here might be a way to be a priest this week. Maybe you should throw a party. Do you know that actually was a big job of the priests in the Old Testament, were to oversee the four festivals that the Israelite people celebrated every year? Now, I'm not suggesting you hold a festival nationwide necessarily this week, but what if you threw a party? What if you took some of what God has given you and you just shared it with others lavishly? Our world tends to hold on to the things that we have. What if you gave it away? What if you invited some neighbors to come and just bask in the glow of your generosity? You know, if you blessed people in that way, you would be a priest. So what would it look like for you to be a priest this week? I want to give us just a minute in quiet to reflect on that, and then we'll move into communion together. So if you would you pray with me? God, if our eyes are closed and hands are folded, awesome. If our eyes are open and we're waving our hands everywhere, that's great too. You hear us no matter what. And what we just want to consider here for a moment, God, is what it would look like to be a priest. How could we show someone this week about your goodness, about how you've brought us out of darkness into light? We're going to be quiet, God, and let you speak to us, and we pray that we would have ears to hear right now.